Good afternoon. I'm Jessica Boyer, the Government Relations Manager for the American Public Health Association. Thank you for giving up your lunch hour to be here. It's too soft? Okay. Is that better?
Yeah.
Great. Thanks. So as you can see, there's just two panelists today and no moderator. So the goal and intent is for this to end up being a pretty informal conversation, as opposed to both Vinny and I talking at you for an hour and a half. This session is part of five that are organized by the Government Relations and the Communications Department at APHA. All throughout the rest of the day, later this afternoon, there's best case examples, mobilizing public health campaign, as well as a session on utilizing social media for public health. But right now, our topic is on advocacy and lobbying, and what is it? So I will be kind of introducing the topic as far as the who, as in you and your organizations, and get a little bit into the what, and then pass it over to Vinny for a little bit more explanation on what it is and then how to execute advocacy. So who here is totally new to advocacy in terms of whatever you think the definition of advocacy is? So everyone here has done some form of advocacy before. That's fantastic. That's great. Well, a few caveats. I'm not a lawyer, and so with some of these definitions, especially when you start getting into tax codes and tax statuses, there's a lot of nitpicky pieces in there. So I will begin this by saying that don't take this as gospel. Please go back and make sure that you find out what your organization and your employer's tax status is and any workplace restrictions that there may be. That said, touching this a little bit, end of the hour and a half, I would like for everyone in the room, hopefully, to be able to walk out understanding a little bit more the differences between advocacy and lobbying, as well as understand a little bit more what some of the parameters in terms of legal ramifications and ethical ramifications around lobbying and advocacy. So these are pretty loose definitions of advocacy and lobbying. Advocacy, loosely defined, is participating in the democratic process by taking action in support of a particular issue or cause. It's about as broad as you can possibly define it. Lobbying is has a much more narrow definition, and generally lobbying is considered to be an individual or organization expressing a view on a specific piece of legislation to any policymaker at any level, state, local, federal, as well as administrative officials. So I don't know if there are any, this is seventh grade math, but what is it, all squares are rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares. The takeaway from that, from advocacy and lobbying, is that all lobbying is advocacy, but not all advocacy is lobbying. You've probably heard about a couple different types of advocacy and lobbying campaigns. The three that we at APHA and within public health and our partners participate in the most are education, advocacy, or media campaigns. Education campaigns is all about getting information out to anyone, to the public, to policymakers, just getting it out there. And that's things like fact sheets, issue briefs, reports, anything that you generate that doesn't have a specific recommendation, you're just sharing facts, would be an education-based campaign. Advocacy is what most of us are more, or an advocacy-specific campaign is what most of us are probably the most familiar with. These are things that would include, you can include the education piece, but then there would also be that ask, so there'd be that call to action. We at APHA refer it to our action alerts, but anything asking for an advocate to act, to respond, to communicate. And then finally, media campaigns, again, can utilize both the education and the advocacy campaign components, but those are things where utilizing members of the media or media formats, whether that's print, online, TV, journalism, but utilizing letters to the editors and op-eds. So a few things, as you, as an individual, what you are entitled and have the freedom to do as an advocate. Every single person can be is an advocate. You have the right to talk to your elected officials about anything that you care about. The issue and the confusion around advocacy and lobbying is what hat you're wearing. When you go in, if you say, I'm here as a constituent, I live on Willowbrook Lane, I want to talk to you about education because I have kids in school, that's you speaking about your experience and your expertise on an issue. However, if you go in and say, I'm here, I live on Willowbrook Lane, but I'm here today because I work for X organization, then that's where you aren't necessarily being an advocate. You may, depending on what you talk about in that meeting with that policymaker, you may be lobbying because you're doing it on someone else other than yourself's behalf. And again, just as an individual, if you're speaking on your behalf, you can't utilize state or federally or federal funds in order to speak to your policymaker. So if you work for a state health department or you work for CDC or HRSA, you can't use funds from your job and from those agencies in order to fly for a lobby day in DC. And just to add to that, that it's your own time. Again, delineating between who is paying for you to be there and who you're speaking on behalf of. And finally, again, just to reiterate this, that every single organization, every different agency may have different rules. So again, to go back and find out what the rules are in terms of your place of employment. So advocacy and lobbying for organizations and associations. Most commonly, if you aren't working for a state, local, or federal agency, if you're a public health advocate, you're more often than not working for a 501c3. A more direct form of lobbying is oftentimes electioneering, where you support one candidate over another. That's the only type of lobbying that 501c3s are prohibited from participating in. And this can get a little bit, again, confusing and is in the gray area because oftentimes there are blackout dates as far as when, if there's any perception that you're trying to impact an election. As a 501c3 organization, there are two different, and this is where the tax code fund begins, there are two different options when you're filing. You can either claim that your organization takes no substantial part in any advocacy activities whatsoever, which would generally mean that none of your funds goes to any kind of advocacy or media advocacy efforts. Or you can do what the majority of 501c3s do, which is the second option, which is called 501H, which basically is a formula based upon your organization's budget. Generally, the cap is at around 25%, but it also depends on how large your budget is, of how much of your efforts that your organization is funding is going to direct advocacy activities. So you're probably familiar, since you're all advocates in the room, with the concept of direct lobbying versus grassroots lobbying. But when it comes to more of the legal issues and tax issues, there's a much different definition of direct versus grassroots lobbying. Direct lobbying is what you think it is. It's, I work for APHA, I go to the Hill and I ask for Senator X to support S-510, the food safety reform bill. That's a direct request to a lawmaker. Grassroots lobbying is oftentimes, we think of that as mobilizing our members at the grassroots level, members and advocates, to influence policy. And that can also mean that that grassroots advocate is asking for their senator to support a specific piece of legislation, but it's coming from, on its own, coming from the population. So, but the trick between the direct versus grassroots in terms of the legal sphere is that direct lobbying is not just me as APHA staff going to member of Congress. Direct lobbying is me also contacting you as members and advocates to respond to a call to action. So in terms of identifying what type of activities your organization might participate in, that call to action piece to your members and not just call to action to lawmakers is considered direct lobbying. Whereas grassroots lobbying is not just to your own members, it needs to be grassroots call to action to the general public at large. So I basically gave you one of these examples, but I'm just curious to see, based on that breakdown, whether or not you can identify where these would, these four examples, whether it be advocacy, lobbying, or neither. So APHA sends a letter signed by Dr. Benjamin, the executive director, to Senate leadership urging them to pass a specific food safety bill. Advocacy, lobbying, or neither? Yes. An APHA member sends a letter through APHA's Take Action webpage, which I encourage you all to visit, to his or her representative asking him or her to support child nutrition legislation. Yes. And it's advocacy because you weren't doing it, even though APHA has asked you to do this, you're doing it, you're writing that letter because it's your own expertise and you're writing on your behalf. The Arizona Public Health Association president is invited to testify before a state legislature committee on the public health implications of current immigration policies. Neither, correct. Anytime a lawmaker approaches you for information, that's not advocacy, that's not lobbying, that's you providing information. So none of those activities, anytime the request comes from the lawmaker rather than being initiated by you, it doesn't count as either. And then finally, an APHA member meets with a congressional staffer to ask for the highest possible funding levels for public health agencies. Advocacy, yes. And again, for the same reason as that letter, you're doing it on your own behalf. Unless you went in and let's say you were on the APHA executive board, and if you're speaking as the executive board, then it would be lobbying. With that, we'll go ahead, that was kind of very, very brief, hopefully terms that you're all familiar with, but if there are any more specific questions, I'd be happy to take an attempt, or Vinny, to answer those now. So let me make sure I have the question right. The question being, if an organization director sends a letter, it is, but only if that organization has opted to file under 501H, because it's not that the letter costs money, but the staff time to produce that letter counts toward that that dollar amount cap for how much percentage of your budget you're spending on advocacy or lobbying efforts. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And again, this is where I'm not a lawyer. So I would definitely recommend, if it's something that you have questions on, and I'm speaking to a counsel. But it's things like you need to keep track and identify both direct lobbying and grassroots lobbying efforts. So it's things like accounting for what percentage of staff time was spent on developing letters to Congress or letters to policymaker. If you use any kind of software package, APHA uses a program called Convio. While the click to send the email doesn't cost money, Convio initially costs X amount of money, so that needs to be factored in to the amount that you're spending. If you're running any type of print outreach or production costs for anything that has a legislative or policy ask, that has to be factored in as part of your direct or grassroots lobbying efforts. Anyone else? All right, well then I will turn it over to Vincent DeMarco, who will introduce himself a little bit to you and then get into some details about some of the campaigns and efforts that he has been actively involved in.
Hello, thank you all very much. I appreciate being here, and thanks, Jessica, for that very good description of all of the rules on advocacy, but I do urge you to take Jessica's advice and talk to a lawyer. And I've had a great lawyer working with me over the years in Maryland, and someone once said to him, "Mike, you must be a really good lawyer, having kept Vinnie DeMarco out of jail all these years." And he said, "Absolutely, that's right." And but it's very important to talk to an attorney on this, because the rules are a little bit complicated. But when you talk to your attorney, you need to ask them two questions, not just one. The first question that all advocates ask is, where's the line I can't get over? And you want to know that line. You don't want to do anything illegal, and you want to make sure you keep within the law in everything you do. But the second question many advocates don't ask, and that's, how do I get as close to that line as possible? Because if you think of this as the line where this is illegal and this is legal, when you're over here, that's as legal as over here, but a lot more effective. And a lot of times, advocates will be scared to do things which they should not be scared to do, that it's perfectly legal to do. And I'm going to talk about some campaigns that we've conducted in Maryland and around the country on advocacy and getting public health measures enacted. And I'm going to talk to you about things which you could do with a 501c3 and with a 501c4, and things you shouldn't do and things you should do, and things which advocates try not, don't do because they're too scared of, but which are very effective and perfectly legal. Over the last 20 years, I've had the great privilege of working on public health issues of reducing gun violence and teen smoking and expanding health care and reducing underage drinking. And one of the things I have found is that the vast majority of people strongly support what we're trying to do. They do, and we all know that. But there is a vociferous and loud minority, and I come across them all the time. I live in Baltimore City, and I went to my neighborhood organization, Northeast Baltimore. Anybody here from Maryland? Anybody? Well, hello. From Northeast Baltimore, and I got their support for our law to reduce gun sales. And then I went back to them to get support for increasing cigarette tax by $1 per pack. And this really big guy at the front of the audience came up to me and said, "Aren't you the guy who came after my guns? And now you're trying to take away my cigarettes. Next thing I know, you're going to come after my ham." And I assured him we were going to leave his ham alone. I didn't tell him I was a vegetarian, because he probably would have shot me. But he calmed down and he supported our proposal, and it worked. But he's not the reason we don't succeed many times. The reason we don't succeed is because there are powerful vested interests with a lot of money who strongly oppose our measures. Why? Because they make profits off of sales of cigarettes and guns and tobacco to kids and alcohol to kids and not changing health care to expand health care. So they make money off the status quo, and they use that money to block our efforts to expand public health. But what I'm here to talk about is that we can mobilize that overwhelming majority who support what we're trying to do, and we can overcome this opposition. And there's actually a book out which is summarized in a packet you have, embarrassingly called The DeMarco Factor, Transforming Public Will into Political Power, which is co-published by the American Public Health Association. The author is Mike Perchik, former FTC chair, founder of the Advocacy Institute. You could buy from APHA at the exhibit center, and I urge you to do that, because that describes the kind of campaigns I'm going to talk about in great detail, and it's very, very informative and helpful for advocates. So what I'd like to talk about is a six-step process that a group of us have put together over the years to expand public health, to transform public will into political power, and to overcome the powerful vested interest opposition that these big corporations use to block us from expanding public health. And as I describe the six steps, I'll talk about the legal issues also that we address with them. Number one step, you identify a problem, whether it's teen smoking, underage drinking, gun deaths, not enough people having health care. You identify the problem, and you look for the best public health means to address that problem. Forget about the politics for a while. Forget about the vested interest opposition. What works? So you ask some of your top experts in your state, and we're lucky in Maryland to have the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health with a lot of public health leaders who really know their stuff, who've studied what's been done in America, what's been done around the country. What are some of the best ways to do this, to address these problems? And we found that a really good way to reduce teen smoking is to increase cigarette tax. It just works. We found, talking to experts, that you can reduce underage drinking and alcohol abuse by increasing the alcohol tax. You could reduce gun violence by limiting gun sales to no more than one per month. And there are many ways that you can expand healthcare. So try first step, and this, of course, is no way lobbying. You could do it as a 501c3 without any of the limits. You can study, you can talk to experts, you can come up with a proposal. In this process of coming up with a proposal, it's sometimes easier and sometimes not as easy. On the cigarette issue and the teen smoking issue, it was relatively easy to determine that increasing cigarette tax is a very effective means to address that problem. When we tried to come up with a proposal to expand healthcare to everybody, it got a little more complicated, you know, as we all know. And one of the options that a lot of people talked about was single-payer Canadian-style healthcare for everyone. But as we looked more closely into that, we found that although there are benefits to it and reasons to do it, it is a political non-starter, not even just thinking about the vested opposition of the powerful vested interest, but just broadly speaking, there isn't broad support for that because a lot of people really want to keep the health insurance they have. They want health care for all, but they don't want one plan for everybody. So in thinking about how to address that, we came up with something which is described in the book called the rule of the thirds. And this is a very, very important thing to think about as you're coming up with a plan to deal with your problem. Any kind of major issue like we're talking about here, you can pretty much divide the public into three parts. Those who are completely against you, the guy with his ham that I talked about. Those who are your base, who support everything we want to do really, really strongly. And those in the middle, who are with you, but, you know, have other things on their mind and not 100% there. So on issues that are a little more complex, you really want to have two things in mind as you develop your proposal. Make sure it's strong enough to save lives and mobilize your base, that third is with you, without turning off the people in the middle. Because if you do that, then you're not getting anywhere. You don't have a chance to even take on the special interest because you're not going to have majority of the public with you in any case. So on healthcare, we use that rule to come up with a healthcare for all plan that has a lot in common with what President Obama and Congress passed that achieves healthcare for all without taking everybody off the insurance they have onto one government-run plan. So think about the rule of the thirds as you come up with this proposal. So that's step one, and that's clearly within what you could do with your tax-deductible foundation money through your 501c3. Step two, when you've come up with this plan, when you've come up with this proposal that will deal with the problem that you think has broad support, do some pretty intensive and serious polling of the public to see how the public in your jurisdiction, whether it's your state, your city, or your nation, feels about the issue. Now, here again, this is something you can do with 501c3 money without being lobbying, as long as, and this is very important, as long as when you get your data from the poll, you release it to the public before you share it with any legislators or any candidates for office, because if you share it privately with a legislator or a candidate for office, then you got some issues and you're lobbying or you're making a political contribution, which you gotta be careful about. So if you don't do that, if you plan to do your polling and release it to the public, then it's public property, you can give it to whomever you wanna give it to. But when you're doing your polling, I strongly urge you to ask more than just the question, do you support? Because if you just ask, do you support something, that's not going to really give you enough information. Do you support an increase in the cigarette tax, limiting gun sales, healthcare for all? That's important, but nowhere near enough. We ask three questions, which I think takes us where we need to go with the polling. First question is, in the upcoming election, for whom are you going to vote, a Democrat or a Republican? Straight up, generic question, which you've heard a lot about. But the second question is, if you knew that the Democrat running for office supports the proposal you're thinking about, a dollar increase in a cigarette tax, a dime a drink alcohol tax, limits on gun sales, whatever it is, and the Republican opposes it, for whom would you vote? Then we ask question number three, what if the Republican supports your proposal and the Democrat opposes it? So we ask those three questions. In Maryland, we've asked it many, many times on these issues, and each time on the issues we've proposed, we found when we asked it straight up, the Democrat was ahead by 10 points. We're a blue state, not a surprise. When we asked if the Democrat supports the public health proposal, the Republican opposes it, we found a significant shift to the Democrat. Sometimes they're up by 20 points. But then when we ask question three, if the Republican supports this proposal and a Democrat opposes it, for whom would you vote? Well, now the Republican's ahead. A significant shift. And on the tobacco issue, when we checked the internals of the poll, we found that the demographic that shifted the most were Republican women. The demographic that shifted the least were Republican men. So I guess they don't talk about it over dinner, right? But clearly key swing groups like moderate Republican women switch on these public health issues. This is very important for two reasons. Number one, it gives you the data you need to know that there is the powerful public will behind your proposal. People don't just support it, they support it strongly enough to make voting decisions on it. And number two, and I'll talk more about this later, you can release that to the public and get some good publicity around it. So you've done step one. You've developed a plan, increasing the cigarette tax, some healthcare plan. And number two, you've tested it and found strong public support. And everything I've talked about so far is completely within what the 501c3 allows you to do and not be in any way lobbying. With that caveat I said about the polling, make sure you release it to the public before you share with any legislators or candidates. So that's step two. Step three is to build a powerful grassroots coalition. And here's where so many advocates, I think, make a big mistake. They want to spend all their time talking to the policymakers. I don't know why they think that if they talk to the same policymaker 100 times rather than 90 times, it'll make a difference. They're not going to listen to you. You've told them already 99 times that this will save lives. The 100th time isn't going to make a difference. You need to show them that it's in their political interest to do what you say. And you don't do that by continuing to talk with them. So for a while, I suggest ignore the policymakers. Make believe they don't exist. Talk instead to the people of your community. Build a powerful coalition. You have that overwhelming majority behind you. They strongly support you. You found that in your polling. Let's mobilize. But how do you reach them? Some of my colleagues like to build organizations with thousands of individual members. Somehow they sign up online or something. I don't particularly like that approach. I like to build a coalition of organizations, each of which have their own hundreds or thousands of members, and then use that coalition to move forward on our issue. But how do you build a coalition? I suggest using a one-page document, which is a resolution, which says, whereas smoking's bad, alcohol abuse is bad, gun violence is bad, resolved. We, the undersigned, United Methodist Church, NAACP, what our Church Women United endorse X, Y, or Z. There's your resolution. A couple of things on the resolution. Make it one page. Those of us who work on these issues love the issue. We work on it all the time. We want to write books about it. We want to write pages. We want to tell people so much. The people we're talking to are very, very busy people in the faith community, right? They got births, deaths, weddings, everything else. Everybody's on their case. They don't want to hear all your stuff. You won't even get to first base with them if you're trying to give them a 10-page document to read. If you have a one-page document and you can really summarize what you're talking about in that one page, you have a chance that they'll look at it. And of course, you have the website and supporting documents if they need more. And then you give them that document and they'll look at it, put it through their process, hopefully, and then hopefully endorse it. Another important point. Getting these organizations to sign these documents is in no way lobbying. Let me say it again, it's in no way lobbying. But if you think about that line that I talked about, right? This is illegal, this is to do, is an illegal lobbying or something, and this is perfectly legal, not lobbying at all. Some people think that getting these organizations to sign these resolutions may be here rather than here, okay? This, when you just find out what the solution is, that's way over here, the polling may be over here, and maybe some people think getting someone to sign something and I support a tobacco tax, well, that's close to lobbying. Maybe it is, but it's perfectly legal. And it's very important that advocates know that they can use their foundation money to go out and get the United Methodist Church or some other organization to sign a document saying that they support this resolution. They have not talked to a legislator. You have not talked to the legislature. It is not lobbying. In fact, I went to the State Ethics Commission of Maryland that regulates lobbying and have a letter from them specifically saying that it is no way lobbying to get an organization to sign this resolution. So do it and go out. And we spend years getting these organizations to sign these documents. And the process of getting these organizations to sign these documents is very helpful. Number one, you build a list of hundreds of organizations. Number two, you answer concerns. When we presented these documents to people, some people would say, well, do alcohol tax increases really reduce underage drinking? Do tobacco taxes really reduce teen smoking? I don't believe it. They do, and here's the data. Won't people go cross-border to buy their cigarettes? Very little, and here's the data. Won't this hurt poor people? No, it'll help poor people, and here's the data. You use that process to educate through them the public. Some of my colleagues like it better when the head of an organization, you hand them the resolution, they sign it right away, and you go off your way. They think that's, I like it better when the head of the organization says, well, I'd rather take it through my process. Well, that's good, I think, because then the other people have to see it, other people get engaged, the organization asks questions, you answer it, and they really get engaged. But that takes time. That's why you don't do this. If your legislative session starts in January 2011, the biggest mistake people make is they try to form their coalition in December. Don't do that. Take a couple of years. Get the process. If this is a really tough issue with a lot of opposition, spend some time building this coalition, going through these processes and building this powerful coalition. And after couple years of this work on each of these issues, we've had hundreds or thousands of organizations sign our resolution, and they form the core of our coalition. So that's step three, forming this broad-based coalition. And again, everything I've talked about so far, all within the 501c3 non-lobbying foundation tax-deductible money. We have hardly talked to a single legislator at all. Step four, the media. Anybody who knows me knows that I love to email or call, but I can't even call 5 million Marylanders. It would take me many decades or hundreds of years. So how do I reach them all? It's through the media, and I like to think of the media as a giant telephone. And it's a telephone that I can get my message out to so many people. And as you know, there are two kinds of media. There's earned media and paid media. Earned media is when an article is written about what you do, an editorial is written, or you do a press conference that gets earned media on TV or radio. Paid media is, of course, when you pay for it. Let me talk about both separately. And again, this is really almost all 501c3 foundation money, not lobbying. Now, if you're in the middle of a legislative session and you do a press conference surrounded by legislators, then you gotta be concerned about it. That might be lobbying, talk to your lawyer. But the kind of thing I'm thinking about when you reach out to coalitions and build support and hold a press conference saying that they've endorsed you, that is not lobbying. And when we built this coalition, every time we got major endorsements of it, we held a press conference to announce it. My favorite one was with faith leaders. And let me talk about this for a second. As you're building your coalition, I urge you, whatever issue you're working on, to focus on building support amongst the faith community. And there are four big reasons. One is the moral authority of the faith leaders open doors for you that others can't open. Second, that's where the grassroots is for you. That's where people are that you can that can make the phone calls, call the legislators, write the letters that you need. Third, it builds tremendous diversity, all kinds of diversity, racial, ethnic, political, all kinds of diversity. And fourth, media. The media loves the faith community taking on big tobacco, the gun lobby, alcohol industry, whoever it is. It's kind of David and Goliath battle. So we had this big press conference with top faith leaders in Maryland, all came together calling for a tobacco tax increase. And the head of the United Methodist Church said he wanted to kick the butts of the tobacco companies. And he was very upset when that wasn't in the paper. He wanted that in the paper. But what was in the paper was the head of the Lutheran Church saying that for years the Lutherans had made fun of the Baptists and the Methodists for getting all excited about tobacco. I'm here to say that the Lutherans were wrong and the Methodists were right. And the Lutherans are going to work with the Methodists to get this done. What happened? Front page of the Baltimore Sun. Clerics back tobacco tax increase. That night on TV, God versus tobacco is what it said in the corner. You can't really beat that. And why did it work so well? Three main reasons. One, we thought carefully about the message. Before you put together a press conference or try to get an article or try to get an op-ed, think about the message. If we had gone to reporters and said, I want you to write that the faith leaders of Maryland don't like smoking and want their congregants to quit, that would have been a big yawn. Nobody would have cared. But the top faith leaders of Maryland want a tobacco tax increase. That's news. And that got all this coverage. Second, let me talk about some other examples of that. On our polling, if we went to the media and said, we want you to cover a story that the majority of Marylanders support tobacco tax increases, big yawn. Nobody would have covered it. But voters would change their position and support candidates who support a tobacco tax. Now that's interesting. That got all the media, that got on the front page of the Baltimore Sun. Similarly, we recently released a study showing that increasing the alcohol tax would save hundreds of lives. Well, that's interesting. And that Maryland alcohol prices are really low. And our experts lined up three bottles, a bottle of alcohol, a bottle of soda, and a bottle of orange juice, and put their price in front of them. And it turns out the bottle of beer was the lowest price, lower than a bottle of juice or a bottle of soda. That's interesting to the media. So that's number one. Think about your story. Think about something interesting. Number two, have good messengers. And we work very hard to have very good messengers. The top faith leaders, they all know and respect, they're going to come cover them. A top national pollster doing your poll, they're going to cover them. Make sure you have good people that the media will be interested in when they come, a top national expert on the issue. They're interesting when you have an interesting message. And one footnote here, a lot of my colleagues in this field like to really script their messengers, almost down to the comma. I don't do that at all. I brief them, listen to their story, and then sometimes I regret it, but usually it works great. And I'm telling you that the media and the public listening can tell if your messenger is completely scripted or is speaking from the heart. So number two, have a good messenger. And number three, take the time to build a relationship with the media. Take the time to get to know them, to talk to them, maybe even when you don't want a story, go out to lunch or breakfast with a new reporter on your beat, get to know them, let them get to know you, answer their questions. When they call you and say, can you answer this question? Maybe even if you don't want to, answer it. Be good to them and they'll be good to you and get to know them. So that's earned media, very, very important for us small nonprofits. But sometimes earned media isn't enough. You want to go beyond that and use paid media. You want to go beyond what the media will write to talk directly to the people. I don't know about you, but I don't have the money for a lot of TV. So we use radio. Radio is significantly less expensive, but it gets your message out. And many times, the newspapers will write a story about your press conference with the radio ad. And so you'll get even more coverage on it. And what do you use it for? You use it to get the message out about what you're trying to say when the public is a little confused or not really sure. Let's talk about tobacco a second. We're proposing significant increase in the tobacco tax. Our polling showed overwhelming support for it. But when we asked, do you really think that increasing the cigarette tax will reduce teen smoking? Only 50% of the public believe that. I don't know why so many people think that young people aren't governed by the rules of economics. They think that young people have all the money in the world. They don't. They respond to price increases like everybody else. So we put together a radio ad to directly address that. And let me play it. Just click it right here.
The following is People Are by MedKai, the Maryland State Medical Society, and Smoke Free Maryland.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. I'm also the mother of four school-aged daughters. Like all parents, I want my children to grow up happy and healthy. So I'm very concerned about teen smoking. Right now, smoking among teenagers is on the rise in Maryland. More Maryland children alive today will die from smoking than from any other single cause. That's 85,000 of our children victimized by tobacco. How can we protect our children? Public health experts say that the best way is to increase the price of cigarettes. They've proven that when the price of tobacco goes up, teen smoking goes down, and the higher we increase the price, the more kids we save. The big tobacco companies don't like it. but it's the right thing to do for all of our children.
For more information, call 410-254-1120.
Notice the ad doesn't say anything about tobacco taxes, doesn't say anything about... doesn't say anything about tobacco taxes or lobbying. This was completely done with 501c3 foundation money. And it worked. Hey, legislators heard that too. It is not lobbying, but they hear it. And they also saw the media coverage of it and all the other media I talked about. So when you do this media, it's not lobbying, but the people you're ultimately trying to influence see it also. Now, we also wanted to address concerns that have been raised. One of the main concerns people raise, people of goodwill, is cigarette tax increases hurt poor people. Actually, cigarette tax increases help poor people by getting them to quit smoking, but we needed a good messenger, and we had a prominent faith leader do this second ad. And let me play it.
This is the Reverend Douglas Myers. For years, tobacco companies have been targeting our teens, working to addict our children to their deadly drug. Big Tobacco has put billboards all over our neighborhood, given away free samples to get our children hooked, and kept their prices low to keep us addicted to cigarettes. Working together, we stood up to Big Tobacco and won the fight to get their billboards out of our neighborhoods. But we must do more. Raising cigarette prices will cut teen smoking, and is one of the best things we can do to protect our health. Now Big Tobacco is trying to convince us that higher cigarette prices would hurt poor people. Don't be fooled. The only people with higher cigarette prices were hurt are the tobacco companies trying to addict our families. God has given us all the gift of life, and we must do our part by keeping our children safe and well.
Thank you.
For more information, call MedKind at 410-539-0872, paid for by MedKind, the Maryland State Medical Society, and by Smoke Free Maryland.
Okay. Again, no mention of lobbying, no contacting legislators. All of this was done with 501c3 foundation money. But we got our message out. And all those steps I've talked about brought us a long way in overcoming the incredible opposition that we had to the tobacco tax increase, and similarly on the other issues we've worked on. So that's step four I've talked about. Step one, get your plan together. Step two, do your smart polling. Step three, build your coalition. Step four, use the media, earned and paid. All of that done with 501c3 foundation money. Now I'm going to switch to step five, which is make your issue an election issue. Yes, there are ways to get involved in elections through a 501c3. I think they are pretty much worthless. That's my opinion. Others disagree with me. I would never spend 501c3 money on election stuff. I just think there are so many tight regulations, it's not worth doing. When you want to work on an election, on an issue like ours, I highly recommend using 501c4 non-tax deductible money. Does everybody know what I mean when I say 501c4 and 501c3? Okay, let me explain it. Under the IRS rules, if you're a nonprofit organization like ours, you could either be a 501c3 or 501c4. Both are tax exempt. Neither pay taxes, and you have to be approved and everything else. The difference is the 501c3 is allowed to take tax deductible money from a foundation, from individuals. The 501c4 cannot take tax deductible money. If you give to a 501c4, it can't be taken as a tax deduction. That's a big difference. It's a lot easier to raise tax deductible money. But there are significant limits on what you could do with 501c3. As Jessica was talking about, you could do a limited amount of lobbying, but you can't do the kind of election work I'm going to talk about. With a 501c4, you could do unlimited lobbying, and you could do a lot of election work up to a certain point. You can't do it with more than like half of your money, but you could do the election work I'm about to talk about. So we could talk at length in Q&A about how you raise that kind of non-tax deductible money. But let me emphasize that what I'm about to talk about is not with our 501c3, but with our 501c4, non-tax deductible money. So what did we do? Well, first of all, something you should know, and I mean, I'll talk more detail if you want, but we had to have the 501c4 purchase the list of the coalition that the 501c3 put together, because we want to use that coalition. So first, the 501c4 purchased that list and had that coalition available to use. Next, We turned that resolution that I talked about, that document that all these groups endorsed, into a candidate's resolution, that we're now going to send it to all the candidates for office. Now, in Maryland, we have primaries in September, general election in November, and the legislative session starts in January. September's a primary. July is the filing deadline. You have to file to run in the September primary and the general election. And every 4 years, our governor and our whole General Assembly is up at one time. So every 4 years, we take a public health issue and put it in front of them in this manner. And how do we do it? We take our document that all these groups have signed, turn it into a candidate's resolution, and right after the filing deadline, we mail it to everybody running. It's very important to mail it to all of them. And we, let me emphasize what we are not. We are not a partisan organization. We are not a PAC. We don't endorse candidates. We love Republicans and Democrats who are with us. We don't like so much Democrats and Republicans who are against us. What we want to do is get them to sign our resolution, and then we want to let the public know who signed it and who didn't. Remember our polling. Our polling showed that if the voters know who supports and who opposes us, they'll tend toward those who support it. We have to get that message out. So this is how we did it. We took that document and we sent it to all the candidates. Now, you know, candidates hate this, right? They hate having to take a position during the election. They want to win on their good looks. Well, we don't care about your good looks. We want to know how you stand on these important public health issues. And I have had some pretty funny experiences with these. The funniest was when we were working on the gun issue, there was this moderate Republican senator who I was hoping would sign on. We sent him the document, and it came right back signed. I put out a list to our coalition. He called me livid. "Vinny, why is my name on that?" And I said, "Well, Senator, here's the document you signed." "Oh, I'm sorry. My secretary signed that without telling me." I said, "Do you want me to take you off the list?" And he said, "No." So I got the better end of that deal. Another time, we were calling these a candidate's pledge, and I got one delegate who supported us saying, "I hate candidate's pledges. I'm never signing another one. I don't care how much I support what you're doing." And I said, "Well, delegate, what if we called it a candidate's resolution?" "Okay, I'll sign that." So from now on, we call them delegate candidate resolutions. So we send them out to everybody, and then we unleash our coalition. We have spent years building this coalition. We have not really had them do a lot of direct work. Now we have them unleashed onto the candidates, demanding that they sign this. From one end of the state to the other, as candidates went to community forums, wherever they went, they were hearing, "Did you sign that resolution yet?" And this was amazing to the candidates. They're not used to this. If you are a community leader in a district and you go to your legislator during a regular session, they like you, they may like you, they want to give you time, but in a way, you're just another pain in the neck, right? They're going to the next hearing, they want to avoid you. During the election time, especially if they have a serious opponent, you're very important to them. So when they come to you for money or your group's endorsement, the first thing they hear from you is, "Did you sign that resolution yet?" It's going to have an impact. And suddenly, more and more candidates were signing these documents. I'll tell you one story which highlights how effective this was. We had one state senator who was wishy-washy on the tobacco issue. She wouldn't sign on. She was being challenged by someone from the lower house who was running against her, signed right away. His campaign was being run by my best friends, and they wanted to attack her as being anti-kids and pro-tobacco. I said, "Well, wait till the deadline." And as deadline came, I convinced this senator she better sign on or this candidate's going to run against her on it. She signed. My friends were livid with me. She ended up winning narrowly. She would have lost if she hadn't signed that. Come next legislative session, she tried to back out, and her local newspaper published her pledge on the front page, and she did the right thing. And this was happening all across the state. So after the deadline, and this happened each time we've done this over the last decade and a half, we had a huge number of candidates who signed our resolution. And what did we do with that? We sent it out to all of our coalition partners. And like the Central Maryland Ecumenical Council sent it to all the 2,000 pastors in their organization. And suddenly the people of Maryland were getting to know how the candidates stood on this issue. And in fact, we did such a good job that some candidates were running on it, on all these different issues, and making it their principal campaign. And after the general election, close to a majority of both houses of the legislature had endorsed our proposal, despite the vocal opposition of the tobacco industry, the alcohol industry, or whoever it was. Now, at this point, you may want to know, Where's all the vaunted opposition? Where are they with all their money? Nowhere. Why is that? Because I like to compare tobacco companies and alcohol lobbyists to cockroaches. Because they do great in the dark, right? Anybody like I, who's been a student with a house infested with cockroaches, know that when the lights are off in the kitchen, they're everywhere. You turn the light on, they're gone. Same thing with these lobbyists. They're very powerful in the halls of your state legislature when no one's watching. But as soon as the light of public opinion is on, they scatter. They did no press conferences announcing that smoking is good and kids should smoke. They didn't do any press conferences. They weren't even mentioned hardly in the stuff we did. So we had the field all to ourselves, except for this one group that the tobacco lobby funded that ran this, what we call AstroTurf campaigns. Everybody know what that mean by that? There's, in football, you know, there's real grass and there's fake AstroTurf. We're a real grassroots organization, and this AstroTurf company was funded by the tobacco companies. We told a reporter about, he wrote a front page story about this fake organization. So the one thing they tried failed miserably. So we ended up doing very, very well on each of these election cycles. But one of the things we learned is that it's hard to make one of our issues a top issue at the gubernatorial level. You can make a top issue or maybe even a sole issue at a legislative level, but how do you do that at the gubernatorial level? So working with some faith leaders, we ran another radio ad. Do not use 501c3 money for what I'm about to play for you. Let me give you some background. The governor of Maryland at the time of our tobacco tax campaign was Paris Glendenny. He was running for re-election. He supported us 100%. He was being opposed by this woman named Ellen Sauerbrey, who had almost beat him 4 years before and was running on an anti-tax platform against us completely. And we knew that, and we wanted to highlight that, so that's why we ran this ad.
The rich special interest groups have a candidate who does whatever they want. Guns, tobacco, casinos. It's Ellen Sauerbrey. The gun lobby. They wanted Sauerbrey to vote against every reasonable gun law, including restrictions on semi-automatic assault weapons. And she did. The big tobacco company. They want Sauerbrey to oppose effective measures to curb teen smoking, such as the Maryland Children's Initiative. And she does. And the casino gambling interests. They want Sauerbrey to stand aside while they fill our state with 10,000 slot machines. And she would. The special interests may control Ellen Sauerbrey, but they don't control you. So vote on Tuesday, November 3rd. Because Maryland is our state, not theirs.
Very subtle, right? This was not to be done with foundation money, but with non-tax-deductible money, you can do this, and it is not campaigning in that it doesn't endorse any candidate. If you like guns, cigarettes, and slot machines, you're for Ellen Sauerbrey, but most Marylanders did not. And this ad got the message out about that and helped win the election for Governor Glendenning, and when he won, he said, I ran on reducing teen smoking by increasing cigarette tax and won big. And that's what you want in an election. You want the candidate who supports you to win, and you want them to give you credit. And that's what our campaign accomplished. So that's step five. Yes?
Wasn't that opposing a candidate? Isn't opposing the same supporting in terms of being involved in an election?
Well, it was definitely involved in an election. Don't get me wrong. This was an issue ad. But it did not endorse any candidate or oppose any candidate. It says, this candidate supports these three things. Basically, if you like these three things, you're for her. If you don't like them, you're not for her. And that's what the message we got out. And you got to, before you do anything like this, you got to talk to your lawyer about all the rules. Never use foundation money for something like this, but you can use issue ad money for it. Yes, question? It says it at the very beginning, Interdenominational Ministerial Alliance.
Okay, no, but so what I wanted to do is differentiate between independent
Yeah, well, you can call it a political ad. That's fine with me. I mean, but there are legal rules on what is an issue ad and what is something that you can only use PAC money, which you got to talk to an attorney about. But the important thing here is it never said vote for or vote against somebody. It's an issue ad. And that makes a big difference in how you do it. And what's important is that, you know, we need to use these kind of ads. We need to get our message out about which candidates are pro public health and which are not. Okay, none of your 501c3 money can be. None. Zero. Zero, zero, zero. Of your 501c4 money, less than half. The rules say a 501c4 cannot be primarily political. Okay? And my attorney has advised us that 49% is not primarily political. So if you have $100,000 of 501c4 non-tax deductible money, you could use $49,000 for ads like this and the kind of getting candidates, telling people how the candidates signed resolution, which didn't, as I talked about. Okay, so that's step five. And I'm gonna quickly do step six and then we'll go into discussion, which I know Jessica wants to do and I wanna do. Step six is go to the legislature and get the bill passed. And here, you can use 501c3 money under the limitations. You can only use 20% for direct lobbying and 5% for grassroots lobbying if you're a 501c3H, or you could use all of your 501c4 money. So what we did was, after having a candidate sign this, we got it, we went in there and got it passed. Now, one thing that happened, which I do wanna talk about for a second, on the tobacco tax, which I've talked mostly about here, we passed the House a dollar increase in the cigarette tax. It went to the state Senate. They made it 36 cents. It went to the Senate floor, and then the other side held a filibuster. And for 3 days, they almost defeated our legislation, but it still passed. It passed. It saved thousands of lives. We did another cigarette tax, which we used to expand health care. I like to say, make sure you do two things, brag and thank. Brag about the success, do press conferences to announce it. We put out a book about highlighting the people who were benefited from it. We did front page ads thanking the governor for doing it. Brag and thank as much as you can. But in addition, hold accountable people who really are opposing you above and beyond just voting against it. And I found when these people held a filibuster to defeat our tobacco tax, that was beyond what anybody should normally do, and I wanted to hold them accountable. So I ran a final radio ad in that campaign, which got me in a lot of trouble. And again, if you use 501c3 money for what I'm about to play you, you'll go to jail. But with 501c4 money or 501c3H, you could do this under your limits. So let me play it. This is lobbying.
A message from the Maryland Children's Initiative.
Joey, Mary.
Choosing sides. What if adults chose sides against kids?
Senator Neal.
No.
Senator Harris.
No.
Senator Jacobs.
No.
It happened in Annapolis. A bill to increase the price of cigarettes by 30 cents a pack came to the Senate floor. Authorities estimated it would save the lives of 8,000 children in our state. One group stubbornly opposed the bill, the big tobacco companies. And when the state senators chose sides, a small number, including Robert Neal, Andrew Harris, and Nancy Jacobs, turned their backs on our kids. Arm in arm with the tobacco lobbyists, they led a desperate filibuster. Fortunately, they lost. So, next time you're asked to choose sides.
Senator Neal.
No.
Senator Harris.
No.
Senator Jacobs.
No.
Think about it.
So for a week, I was the talk of right-wing radio. I was denounced up and down the state. Some of our friends got very mad. The State Medical Society denounced me, and a reporter said, "What do you think of the State Medical Society denouncing you?" I said, "Well, they're a great organization. We just disagree." And he wrote in the Sun, "Vinnie DeMarco would see the bright side of an IRS audit." And that's what this felt like. It felt really, really bad. If you had asked me then, should we pull his ad? Yes, but this was 1999. In 2002, there was another cigarette tax. In 2007, there was another cigarette tax. Not a whiff of a filibuster. And let me close with this. Over the last decade, because of these three cigarette tax increases, Maryland smoking dropped 32%. Double the national average. Double the national average. 70,000 lives saved. And in your packet is what's become my favorite chart in the whole world. And this is a chart which shows that cigarette sales dropped each time we raise a cigarette tax. So if you have a friend who says public policy don't work, put this in their face. But my point is, The public policies work, but they only work because we did this six-step process to overcome vested interest opposition. That's all I got. Thank you very much.
Getting this set up again, are there any questions? It looks like we ran out of the packets. If you go to room 206, by 2:30, I will have extra packets available on the front table when you walk in.
More stuff here.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, yes?
Could you repeat the name of the book you referenced?
DeMarco Factor, Transforming Public Will into Political Power. It's available on Amazon and also available through ADHA. And this is a flyer about it that I have up here.
Yeah, in the back.
About the cost of polling and ads, you know, a lot of people just barely have enough money to do what we do.
Yeah, it's a good question. That campaign that I talked about on tobacco, we spent a total of about 200,000 from 1997 to 1999, about 200,000 of 501c3 foundation money, and about 100,000 of 501c4 money. Plus other people put in some ads for another $100,000 or so. So it was about $400,000 for that whole campaign, which is pretty bare bones. And the polling, one of the important things about polling is you gotta do it right and don't scrimp on it if you can help it. And make sure you use a pollster that people will respect. And sometimes that means a national pollster, sometimes it means a pollster in your state that is highly regarded. Sometimes you can, if you only need a couple questions asked, you can buy a question onto a poll being done anyway by a pollster in your state, which will only cost a little bit. But don't scrimp on this if you can. And make sure you ask the three questions I talked about, because they'll give you some really good help. And well, the cost of our polling range from about $5,000 to $25,000. Our initial polls, we spent a substantial amount because we had a lot of questions we want to ask. We wanted to ask that question, do you really think increased cigarette tax will reduce teen smoking? Do you really want health care for all? How would you pay for it? So on all these issues, our initial poll, we spent a lot of money. Then we did subsequent polls that cost a lot less. The radio ads, if you can raise it, are a good use of your money. And in Baltimore, I mean, every media market's different. In Baltimore, for $10,000, you could buy a good week of radio ad that will be heard. Better if you spend $30,000 or $40,000. That's part of our state. We also are border on D.C., and that's a lot more expensive. $10,000 in a D.C. media market will not buy you much, but in a Baltimore media market, it will. So it depends on your media market. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Do you have any recommendations about whether to go for a large tax at once or incrementally like you did? I'm from Missouri, the making state.
Yeah.
The lowest in the nation.
You are. It's an excellent question. And there are things to think about on both sides of that. Number one, you save more lives if it's a higher tax. The more, don't even bother for 5 cents. Okay, that's really, really ridiculously low and won't save any lives.
We're at 17.
I know, you're at 17, the lowest in the country, and it's failed twice by ballot. You get a prize for that. I don't know what kind of prize. But the polls I've seen show that the public support doesn't change, whether it's $1 or $2. It's still the same broad public support. And so I would always urge you to start with something like that, with a dollar. I urge you always start with a dollar. But if you're in a legislative session, you may have to compromise and be willing to do that, as long as it's not too low. The thing I would advise Missouri is to do this, but do it the way we put it together, with spend some time building a broad-based coalition before it goes on a ballot or you try in the legislature again, and get the faith community engaged. And, you know, to me, the most important thing in a situation like you have is to make sure that the public understands that about how effective this is to reduce teen smoking. And you can tell them about our success in Maryland and success in other states, but spend the time, and it's hard because it takes money and it takes a lot of work, spend the time over a year or two to reach out to all the different constituencies and get their endorsement before you put on a ballot. I think that the mistake that was made in Missouri is that people put it on the ballot before building the broad coalition, and so that when the other side hit with, well, this isn't about saving kids, this is about a money grab, the people weren't ready, they hadn't heard the real facts. So I would urge you to spend some time building a coalition first. Anything else? Who hasn't asked yet? Yes. Well, where are you from?
Illinois.
Well, I mean, it depends on your organization and depends on your state, of course. But every state has foundations that are interested in this kind of work. And some foundations are scared of anything that's related to advocacy and will not fund a project that builds a coalition around something because they're afraid of it. Other foundations love that kind of work. And you got to be able to identify those. But the thing I would recommend to you is before going to a foundation or to an individual to ask for money, put together a plan. Put together a plan that shows how their money will help achieve this long-term goal that they want to achieve, whether it's reducing smoking, reducing underage drinking, reducing gun violence, helping to implement the federal reform. You say, Mr. Foundation, Ms. Foundation, donor, I have a plan. Your money can help make that plan happen, and we will use it legally in these ways, et cetera. So if you have a plan, you can make it happen. And again, I urge you to pick up the DeMarco Factor book because there's a lot in there about how to approach these foundations and how to make that happen. Who else has questions? Yes, sir. Well, you know, we'll have to disagree. My experience has been that the people in the middle in Maryland, I think this is true in America, don't want one healthcare plan for everybody and be taken off the healthcare they have. And I believe it undermines our ability to achieve health. You know, one of the things that frustrates me about this whole healthcare debate is right now you see these polls, 50% of the people like the federal healthcare law and 50% don't like it. About a quarter of the people who say they don't like it because it isn't single payer or because it isn't everything they want, which is frustrating to me. And the other thing that's frustrating to me is that many of the other people who don't like it because they think it is single payer or will be moving in that direction. And that is, I think, anathema to such a broad swath of Americans that if as long as we have that up there, it prevents us from achieving our goals. And that's how I feel. I know, I understand what you're saying, and it's a point that we just have to disagree on.
No, I would just like to say that I really appreciate your time to use all of your points.
Good. Good. I'm glad.
Single-payer health insurance arrived in this country 45 years ago.
Medicare. I understand. And one of the great things about Medicare is I heard this, actually. I heard people say, keep government's hands off my Medicare. And that is one of the most hysterical things I've heard in healthcare. Any other questions? Good luck to you. Yes, ma'am. Adapted what? Sure, that would be wonderful. Where in Africa? Oh, great. Well, all I can suggest is that you pick up a copy of the DeMarco Factor book and bring it with you over there. Anything else?
Thank you all for coming. Actually, to the last question, I believe there actually is an International Health Section sponsored advocacy session that was either today or will be tomorrow. So I would check out the schedule because I believe it's going to be a panelist, a speaker, similar to Vinny's presentation. So again, for those of you who came in late and didn't get the APHA Advocacy Handbook or the packet of materials, there are extra copies in the association office in room 206. If there's no other questions, thanks again for coming. I'd invite you to stay in the room at 2:30. There'll be an Action Board-sponsored Mobilizing Public Health Campaign session, and then at 4:30, utilizing social media for public health efforts. Thanks again.
If anybody needs any of you, they're here.